So welcome everyone to this week's Quantum Matter Frontier Seminar. We're very happy to have Roman Vasseur talking. He's a professor from UMass Amherst, and he's worked on a wide swath of modern topics of condensed matter physics, ranging from thermalization, many-body localization, to topological phases and non-equilibrium dynamics. So we're very happy to have him here talk about some measurement-induced entanglement transitions. Ramit, please go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Tim, for the introduction and for inviting me. So today I'd like to tell you about some topic I've been working on for the past couple of years on measurement-induced phase transitions. And so, you know, part of this talk will be some kind of introduction to those transitions. And I know there are experts in the audience, but I'll just try to make sure that everyone is on the same page. And in particular, I'll tell you about a recent type of phase transition that's induced by measurements, which we call a charge sharpening transition, which will have to do with the ability of an observer to kind of extract information about the charge of the system. Okay. So of course, please feel free to interrupt me with questions. All right, so before we start, I have a slide with collaborators. I happen to have many collaborators on this particular topic. So some of them are in the audience. I won't go through the whole list, but let me just at least highlight my student, Utkarsh Agrawal, who was really the driving force on this topic of charge sharpening transition. And he'll soon be moving to KITP. But the project I'm going to tell you about, we're done with all of those people. Okay. All right, so let me start by kind of putting the story I want to tell you about in a broader perspective. Broadly speaking, the type of story I'm going to tell you about has to do with just non-equilibrium quantum dynamics of many-body quantum systems. And so it's a very rich field and with many fundamental questions, where instead of thinking of a many-body quantum system in thermal equilibrium, where you would care with, you would care about the ground state properties or low energy physics, we're rather interested in, the dynamics of systems, if they're possibly being isolated or maybe not entirely isolated. There are many fundamental questions that many people, including myself, have been thinking about related to thermalization, to whether you can get new interesting non-equilibrium states of matter that you maybe would be forbidden in equilibrium, whether you can get some, the beautiful things that we love in equilibrium physics, where maybe we could get universal phenomena, critical exponents, universality, phase transitions, and so on. Okay. And this topic, you can also ask about the role of the environment, which will kind of play an important role in the story I want to tell you about, at least a specific type of environment. Okay. So since this talk is going to be about entanglements to some extent, at least the beginning of it, but I'll move away from entanglement at some point, let me just have a brief reminder about how entanglement behaves in generic many-body quantum systems. Okay, so if you take an isolated quantum system for now, you just imagine you prepare the system in some pure state that you can prepare experimentally, maybe a product state, and you just imagine unitary evolution. So what we expect for at least generic enough quantum systems, and excluding cases of, say, strong disorder or many-body localization or anything like this, is that the system will reach equilibrium on its own. And what it means is that if you consider a subsystem A of your system and you think of, say, local observables in A, they will essentially forget about the initial condition of that system. And the only thing you'll remember will be global conserved quantities. So say if you have a Hamiltonian system, energy is conserved, you will have maybe just some effective temperature. And that's the only memory of the initial state you will have as far as those local observables are concerned. Okay. So in particular, if you consider like a reduced density matrix of subregion A, Even though your full system is in a pure state, this will quickly become mixed, and at long times will approach a Gibbs distribution, say, and so the von Neumann entropy of that reduced density matrix will be extensive. So this is called entanglement entropy between A and the rest of the region A bar, and extensivity will be called volume loss scaling in this context. Okay, and so how does that behave as the function of time? Well, it's something that has been investigated by many people, again, including in the audience, in particular by Kim and Hughes and Gardi and Calabrese in the context of CFTs. So as a function of time, this entanglement entropy will grow linearly until it saturates to some volume loss scaling. Okay, so this is kind of the generic behavior of this entanglement entropy as it evolves from, say, starting from a low entangled, from a state with low entanglement to some, say, maybe thermalized states where you have extensive volume low entanglement. So the type of system I'm going to be working on largely in this talk won't be Hamiltonian systems. And in fact, they will be as featureless as possible. And so this will be following the works of Adam Nahum in particular and collaborators. So I'm going to be thinking of the dynamics of random unitary quantum circuits. So largely the motivation here will be, as far as I'm concerned, from a, also just from a purely theory point of view, is that the systems will be more tractable and they will allow for more analytical tools. But basically the way I like to think of random unitary quantum circuits is that it's really building on the idea of random matrix theory. The kind of toy models for quantum dynamics for which you think of a model which is as featureless as possible and only has the key ingredients you want to think about, and they allow for, they're simple enough that they can be solved exactly to some extent. Okay. So again, just to make sure that everyone is on the same page, I'm going to be drawing a lot of diagrams like the one in the lower left corner, where I have a system. I'm going to be restricted to 1D in this talk, even though the story I want to tell you about actually generalizes to higher D. So I have a one-dimensional system, maybe a chain of qubits or qdits if you want. And the time evolution will be a discrete time evolution given by this brick wall pattern of unitary gates. So each red rectangle is a unitary gate acting on nearest neighbor qubits. And I will, so there's no energy conservation in this system. And in fact, I will even take, again, following those original work, I will take each gate to be random in space and in time. Okay. So this is, of course, a pretty featureless model. The two things you keep are unitarity. So you have quantum evolution and you have locality, okay, where because your gate, because of that brick wall pattern, you only have local interactions. Okay. And so in such quantum circuits, you can essentially keep track of, for example, entanglement entropy exactly. And it's known, and it does behave as you would expect. It grows linearly with time and it saturates to something extensive in the size of the interval in those systems. Okay. And so again, at this point, there's no conserved quantity at all. All right, so the other ingredients that I'm going to have in this talk are measurements. Okay, and so this is this concept of measurement-induced phase transitions. So this was introduced in those two beautiful papers by Skinner, Ruhmann, and Nahum, and Li Chen and Fisher, and again, some of the authors and in the audience. So what those authors did is come up with simple models that can actually have a transition due to the competition of two very simple ingredients. So the first one is just chaotic generic quantum dynamics, which again, we're going to model as just a random unitary circuit. Okay, so this is not really crucial to the physics, but this is just a way to put some generic quantum dynamics, which is non-integrable, and will quickly scramble any type of information you have in your initial state into highly non-local degrees of freedom. Okay. And so the other ingredient will be measurements. Okay. So those measurements in that diagram are represented by those blue dots. So every time there's a blue dot, what it means is that with some probability P, you're going to measure the state of, say, this qubit. Okay. So you only do this with probability P. So and when you measure, it's really a quantum measurement. It's projective. So if you measure your qubit to be up, you will project it. You'll have a projector. You'll project your wave function, and the outcome of the measurements is determined by the usual laws of quantum mechanics. So the basic intuition for why this gives you some interesting competition is that, okay, if P is zero, you never measure, you just have unitary evolution. And so again, your system becomes highly entangled very quickly, and you just have chaotic dynamics with quick entanglement growth. On the other hand, if P equals one, say, at every single time step, you measure every single qubit in your system, and what you get is just a classical outcome, right? Where maybe the first spin is up, the second spin is down, and so on. And this has zero entanglement, at least between your spins. Okay. And so what those authors argued and studied numerically is that you can actually have a phase transition as a function of that rate of measurements. Okay. And so this is some plot from the paper by Li Chen and Fisher, showing entanglements in a steady state if you run those circuits for a very long time as a function of subsystem size, and it basically shows the transition between a volume law scaling where entanglement is scales with the size of the interval that you consider. But if you crank up P, eventually it seems to just saturate to some value that doesn't depend on the subsystem size. Okay. All right, and so there are many different perspectives of this on this transition that I won't talk too much about. And one perspective is that you should think that the scrambling dynamics is kind of hiding degrees of freedom, like some quantum information about your initial state into highly non-local degrees of freedom that cannot be accessed by the local measurements. At least if you're in that volume law phase, but the effective size of that subspace that's kind of protected from the measurements is kind of decreasing as you reach this transition here. And above that threshold, the measurements are very rapidly able to kind of extract all the information you can think of about the initial state. All right, so this is this concept of measurement-induced transitions that got many people interested, including myself. It looks like a very interesting and very fundamental transition, and you just have minimal ingredients. And it's a phase transition that occurs purely in entanglement, but it occurs purely in this non-equilibrium type setting. So one very important point that I should emphasize right away is that this is kind of a very unusual type of transition also in the way that it's set up. And it has to do with it's really important to think of those measurements as being actual measurements. In particular, that phase transition occurs only in so-called quantum trajectories. Okay, so in this quantum trajectory picture, if you have an observer, some environment that's measuring a system, you're thinking that your wave function always remains a pure state. Okay, so you start with your wave function, say you have some measurement outcomes. You're projecting your wave function onto those measurement outcomes. I'm calling pi m the projector here. And say if you have a single measurement operator, you just project onto, say, eigenstate of that operator, which would be, say, up or down. So you say you measure a qubit along the z-axis or something. And okay, so that wave function in called psi m, which is associated with some measurement outcome m, is a quantum trajectory. So you can imagine you have different universes where you have different measurement outcomes, and they give you different wave functions. It's not normalized in the way I wrote it. And in fact, the norm is precisely the Born probability. So that is to say the probability of which this trajectory will occur. Okay, so this is this quantum trajectory picture, and you can think of the properties of those quantum trajectories. So when you learn about quantum mechanics, or when you learn about measurements that is the way I did, you know, sometimes it's also formulated in terms of in modern language would be like a quantum channel for the time evolution of your density matrix, where you think that your system is in some mixed states, which is the superposition of those measurement outcomes. So this really corresponds to if you want tracing out the environment, forgetting about the measurement outcomes, and your system will be in some classical superposition of those states. And so sometimes quantum trajectories are kind of thought as just a way to kind of think of this mixed density matrix. And so if you think of maybe natural physical quantities, like you want to compute the average of some observable, the perspective of quantum trajectories versus thinking of that mixed density matrix actually give you the same answer. So if you want to average, say, this observable again over quantum trajectories, so you summing over all measurement outcomes, say you have many measurements, they occur with some probability Pm, and what this is just the average of all in a given trajectory. And so you see that the bound probability factor cancels out, and this gives you effectively just some expectation value that you can reformulate in terms of that mixed density matrix. Okay. However, if you think of nonlinear quantities, and say you want to compute the average over trajectories of some square of some expectation value, this really is something that is unique to the quantum trajectories, and it doesn't have a natural equivalent in terms of that mixed density matrix. Okay. So this is a very important point. Like all the transitions I'm going to tell you about, they're actually properties that are unique to quantum trajectories, and they're completely invisible in that quantum channel perspective. So it's not like we have a Lindblad equation and we can think of or a quantum channel in discrete time that will give us the evolution of a mixed density matrix and a transition occurs in that language. All the transitions I'm going to be talking about occur in the quantum trajectories, and they're invisible from that perspective of rho. Okay. So in particular, the entanglement entropy here is the entanglement entropy of a quantum trajectory, average of all possible quantum trajectories. Okay. So I'm really trying to emphasize this point because it's, I think, really crucial. And of course, it might occur to you that this type of observable is very bizarre. If you wanted to measure it in real life, even if you had a quantum computer, you would run into problems because you would have to maybe prepare this state psi m for fixed measurement outcomes many, many times. So it kind of suffer naturally from some post-selection problem, which many people have been trying to work around in recent years, but I won't talk too much about. So again, please interrupt me if anything is unclear at this point. Okay, very briefly, just some numerical evidence from those original papers that you have a transition. So you compute, say, Reni entropies or entanglement entropies, and you can do relatively standard finite size scaling. And at the end of the day, what you seem to get is some nice second order phase transitions where you have some exponents that appear to be universal. So say there's a correlation length exponent, there's a dynamical exponent, and it seems near one. And there are even numerical, there's some numerical evidence for conformal invariance, for example. Despite the system being essentially very high, very far from equilibrium, there seems to be some kind of nice phase transition, just like the ones you would have in, say, in just classical statistical mechanics models. And so this is not a coincidence. In fact, the way we, or at least I, understand those transitions is through some mappings onto statistical mechanics models. So let me just say a few words about this. This would be the topic of an entirely different talk, so I won't go into any type of technical details, but just the resulting picture will be useful for some of the things I'm going to tell you about. So the claim is that you can simulate those systems numerically, but going beyond this, what you can do is also map the calculation of, say, entanglement entropy exactly onto some effective statistical mechanics model. And the basic idea behind it is you need some sort of replicatrix. So you can think that you need a replicatrix because you need to average a log. But it's a bit deeper than this. It's just the measurement problem is nonlinear, kind of by definition. And you need some replica trick. So you need to replicate your system if you want to analytically deal with those nonlinearities. So formally, this looks like a formula like the one I wrote here, where you just rewrite a log to this. And the basic observation is that at least if you have like integer powers of a density matrix, this is something that you can average exactly. And again, this is building on many previous works on unitary quantum circuits and on random tensor networks in particular. And so the basic claim is would be schematically something like that. So if you want to compute like moments of a density matrix, so here when I write rho, I actually mean a pure state density matrix. So just time evolution of those for a given trajectory, you have, there should be an M label here. So this is for a given set of measurement outcomes. So you have this density matrix and you copy your system Q times, and the exact average of this can be rewritten formally as a type of partition function of a classical stat-mech model that would live in two dimensions. And the degrees of freedom happen to be permutations. Okay. So again, I'll skip any type of derivation of this. The important thing for me will be that it gives you, you know, it's a fairly technical step, but it gives you, I think, some very simple and intuitive picture of what the transition is. And so this is a picture that many of us are using to try to understand like the general scaling properties of those transitions. And so the basic claim is that entanglements in that complicated quantum system where you have chaotic dynamics plus the measurements ends up mapping to something very familiar in an effective statistical mechanics model. And the mapping maps entanglement to some free energy cost of inserting domain walls in stat-mech models. And so this leads to some pretty appealing picture of entanglement in terms of some membrane, if you want, or some domain wall in a model. And so very schematically, and so this is some figure borrowed from that paper here. This is what it looks like. Imagine, say, you have an Ising model. So our stat-mech model is actually a bit more complicated than an Ising model. And entanglement is basically thinking, say that stat-mech model is in a ferromagnetic phase. Imagine you have like uniform boundary conditions. So say all spins are up at some boundary. So the top layer here would be like at a given time in your system. Imagine now in the region A where you want to compute entanglement of, you fix the spins to be a different value, say minus. And so this creates a domain wall which will have some finite line tension here in the system. And so the claim is that the free energy cost of like inserting that domain wall is precisely entanglement. And so in that regime, it's extensive. And through this mapping, you also see that the measurement-induced phase transitions and transition ends up being a type, just a phase transition, a disordering transition in that stat-mech model. So P, the measurement rate, plays the role of the temperature. And so if you increase P, basically you go to a disordered paramagnetic phase, and here changing the boundary condition has just some constant energy cost. You just have a domain wall condensate anyway, and so this ends up giving you a pretty simple picture of what that transition is going from volume low to area low. Okay, so maybe I should just take a pause here. That was a pretty extended introduction of just what we understand about measurement-induced phase transition, what I understand from measurement-induced phase transitions without symmetries. So maybe I can take a quick pause just to see if there's any question. Okay, so maybe this was all too basic and everyone in the audience is already familiar with all that stuff. There's of course a lot more I could say about measurement-induced phase transition in general, but for the rest of this talk, I want to talk about symmetries. I'll be thinking of now systems where that includes some conservation law. So we're basically trying to move away from that completely featureless limits. And we'll add a minimal ingredient, which will just be charge conservation. So there were previous works, including by team and collaborators, for example, to add, say, Ising type symmetries on systems with, you know, on such systems where you have measurements and unitary evolution. So here I'm going to again think of charge conservation, so some U1 conservation law, if you want. And there are several ways that could motivate this. So one way would be from the point of view of phase transitions. Of course, we know that considering different type of symmetry will give you different universality classes. And so you could ask pretty naturally, do we expect a different symmetry class here? There's maybe a deeper reason, which is that if you have some charge conservation, we know that there will be some hydrodynamic mode. We know charge will have to diffuse. And so the information about the charge, the way it's spreading in the system is constrained by the symmetry and will be very different from generic degrees of freedom. So you could expect that something qualitatively new will occur. And in fact, what I will hopefully convince you of is there's something genuinely new that occurs and there's a new type of phase transition here. Okay. So this will be related to the fact that if you want the scrambling properties, the way quantum information is spreading is different with the U1 conservation law. At least there are some operators that spread in a very different way. It's already known, in fact, that, for example, different Rényi entropies or different the way entanglement is scaling in systems that have just charge conservation law can already be affected and be pretty unusual. Okay. And so the techniques I'm going to tell you about, I will generalize kind of generically to any type of abelian symmetry, but it will be especially interesting if there's a continuous symmetry. Okay. All right, so here's the model I'm going to be thinking about. So again, we're going to think of a quantum circuit type model just because it will make our life easier. And we're hoping to model something relatively generic. So we tried several variants, and I'm going to tell you about the one that gives you something kind of tractable. And again, I should also give credit to my student Utkarsh for some of the slides I'm showing you here. So I'm going to think of a model where you have we have some qubit degree of freedom that will obey some U1 symmetry. So meaning, say, the Z component of that qubit will be conserved throughout the system. You can think it's a two-level system, charge 0, 1, and we want the total charge to be conserved. And we're also going to add like some background qdit degree of freedom, some d-level system with no symmetry on it. Okay. And so I should say this particular model of dynamics was studied before without measurements in some reference here. Yeah. So okay, so we have otherwise it's basically the same model as before. We have unitary evolution. So now the gates have some block diagonal structure in a way that will just conserve that charge. Okay, so so that's the only structure we put. Otherwise, each block is just random, or will be from the Hall measure. And we have some measurements, and each measurement is actually a simultaneous measurement of both the qdit and the qbit degree of freedom. And we're measuring the qbit degree of freedom along the Z in the Z basis, which is the basis that's compatible with symmetry. So the claim that I'm going to make, and it's something that we really learn through some mapping again onto a statistical mechanics model, is that we can take this model and we can map it to some classical statistical mechanics model, which will actually be of a different type. And this statistical mechanics model will end up being especially intuitive and nice if this parameter D, the size of this neutral degree of freedom, goes to infinity. So this will be kind of a large N limit, if you want, of the model in which things will become tractable. And that effective statistical mechanics model will be nice And in a sense that you can do classical simulations with it, and efficiently, a lot more efficiently than just looking at the quantum system. And it will also allow us to, you know, use kind of more standard tools like field theory to understand what's going on. And so the basic claim of this talk, the punchline, will be that in addition to the entanglement transition that I already mentioned, which here in that limit, actually, it's a percolation transition and it occurs at critical rate 1/2. So that separates volume law and area law. Within the volume law phase, there's an additional transition that we call charge sharpening transition that I will denote by P sharp, and which will have to do with the ability of the measurements to kind of reveal the charge of the system. So can you imagine that maybe your initial state will be some quantum superposition of many different charge sectors, and with your measurements, you're kind of collapsing the charge more and more. And above that threshold, you will basically completely sharpen the charge of the system. Okay. So of course, that's a little bit of a cartoon picture. The situation is a little more complicated than this, and I'll go through the details. Okay, so a couple of technical steps first. I won't go through the technical details, but just schematically, what can we do here? So just like before, we can use those type of statistical mappings. So we can take our system, we have to use some type of replica trick, again, because of this measurement problem that's intrinsically nonlinear. So we have different copies of the system and we can average exactly over the unitary gates and over the measurement outcomes and where you put the measurement locations as well. And we can do this exactly, and we can actually, so this is the part that's actually non-trivial, highly non-trivial and took us a long time. You can actually take the replica limit analytically. So by replica limit, I mean this limit here, right? So you're rewriting the log as some, say, derivative, and you need to take this limit. This is always the hard part about the statistical mechanics models. We need to take that replica limit. And this ends up being very hard in general, but in that model, in that large delimit, you can actually do this exactly. And as you do this, what you find is an effective model for the charge degrees of freedom in that system. And so that model will basically be defined on a tilted square lattice like this. On each link, there's a classical charge 0, 1 that represents really the physical charge in the system. And those charges will be constrained by the links that are measured that are defined in red here. So I'll say a few more words about the statistical mechanics model in the next slide. Let me just say a few words about observables. We can here again think of entanglements, but it's actually something a lot nicer and a lot simpler to think about, which is just think of correlation functions of the charge operators. In particular, you can think of, say, the variance of the total charge in a given quantum trajectory, and which would be an object like that. So this would tell you this would tell you about the charge variance. So if this is zero, it means that you have a very well-defined charge, but otherwise it could be very well not zero. One important thing is that this is a non-trivial observable, okay? If you average over different trajectories, so you sum over M, this first part is actually trivial, but the second part isn't, because again, it has this square here. So all the physics will actually be in this disconnected part. So what's this statistical mechanics model? Well, it ends up being something pretty simple and that I think is relatively intuitive. So you have those, again, you have this tilted square lattice. On each link, there's a charge degree of freedom. Each vertex ends up having a different weight given by those rules. Okay, so this is a standard statistical mechanics model, which is known as the six vertex model. But physically, it also maps to something even maybe more intuitive, which is a symmetric exclusion process. So intuitively, what this is just your charges are moving and diffusing through the system. That's all this is. So for example, what this vertex tells you here is that if you have a charge that's incoming, so time is running in the upward direction here, in the vertical direction. So you have a charge coming in, and then it has a probability 1/2 to go to the left, probability 1/2 to go to the right. So what you have is a bunch of random walkers with hardcore interactions that are just diffusing. And hopefully that makes sense to just what, you know, charges are doing in the system. So this is a very simple model, but the non-trivial physics will come from the measurements. Measurements here act as some kind of quench disorder in that model. So on each red link, the measurement outcome is, say, fixed to 0 or 1. And this will constrain what the charge does. So say you have a bunch of those red links and you have a bunch of measurement outcomes, 0 or 1s. And what the StatMech model is doing is basically counting the number of configurations of those random walkers that are compatible with those measurement outcomes. So at the end of the day, we will also sum over, you know, the different measurement outcomes and the different measurement locations. And there's some appropriate bound probability that comes out of that statistical mechanics model as well. But hopefully this is relatively intuitive, right? So what the static MEG model does is kind of forgets entirely about quantum mechanics, but it just counts compatible charge configurations. So why is, you know, how does that give us something useful? Well, you can run this numerically. So you can actually run this on pretty big systems. I'm showing you system sizes that are fairly modest, but you can actually run this to at least 60 or something sites. So you can run that statistical mechanics model and you can average over quantum trajectories and you can look at, say, this average of the charge variance as a function of that measurement rates. And so in that model, like, there is a phase transition again in entanglements at 1/2 that comes from essentially those qdid degrees of freedom that I'm not really focusing on. But you see this charge variance actually has a crossing and at a pretty small value of p, maybe near 0.2, maybe a bit below. Where here, like, as you increase system size, like, this charge variance is actually increasing. Whereas above this crossing, this charge variance as you increase system size is actually decreasing. So meaning that you basically get a state where whose charge is more and more well-defined. So this is this transition of charge sharpening. And the basic idea will be that in above that threshold, the measurements will be able to fully sharpen the charge of the system until you start from some initial state, which is in a superposition of many charge sectors. Above that critical threshold, your given quantum trajectories will collapse onto well-defined charge sectors. Whereas below that threshold, the charge will remain fuzzy, meaning not particularly well-defined. And so this occurs completely inside the entangling or volume law phase, and it appears to be completely, it's pretty far away from the entanglement transition. So we can be more quantitative, and let me do that right away. So what actually changes at this phase transition? Well, the claim is you have this change in behavior in charge correlators. The phase diagram that we claim is correct is the following, and it only requires, again, just minimal ingredients. So you have quantum dynamics, measurements, and charge conservation. And so as a function of this measurement rates, there's again this entanglement transition that I won't be talking about. In that limit, it's no different from the case where you don't have symmetries. But inside the volume law phase, you have two phases that we call charge fuzzy and charge sharp, with this transition P sharp in the middle. One way to, for example, diagnose this transition is to look at charge correlators. So within a given trajectory, you look at ZZ correlators or charge-charge correlator. And again, you average this over different quantum trajectories, different measurement outcomes. And the claim is that there's a phase transition again in that quantity. So in that charge fuzzy regime, this ends up being algebraic. I'll give you some theory reason for this in the last 10 minutes or so that I have. And above that threshold, it ends up decaying exponentially. Okay, and so this is something that we can observe numerically. There's this nice parallel regime of this quantity. And if you actually integrate this twice, this also gives you that in the fuzzy phase, this charge variance for an interval of charge L is scaling logarithmically with L. You see how the charge variance is changing from those formulas here. All right, so let me just say a few words about how we actually understand this. So there are a bunch of things that you can do. So the first thing that you can think about, maybe just intuitively, is think of the regime where you have small measurement rates. So let's say P is very small. And let's think about like how you would estimate the charge of the system. So let's say you have a state which now maybe has a given charge, and you perform some measurements that are pretty sparse. And let's say you want to estimate the charge of the system. If you have capital N measurements, you would just say, well, your estimate will just be based on averaging those measurement outcomes. So say if you did 100 measurements and 50 of them gave you charge 0, 50 of them gave you charge 1, you would say maybe your system has charge L over 2, so it's roughly at half filling. So when is that good enough? In order for this to be good enough, you want your measurements to be able to distinguish a charge, a state of charge Q and a state of charge Q plus 1. Okay, so you want this estimate of the charge to be accurate enough to distinguish different charges. So you want this error to be less than unity. And so a very simple central limit estimate of this. So this is assuming again that my measurements give me completely independent outcomes. So obviously this is only going to be okay at small p. So you see that you need the number of measurements needs to be larger than something of order L squared in order for those measurements to be able to fully extract the charge of the system. Okay. And so now in a system where your rate of measurement is P of size L of time T, the number of measurement is the product P times L times T. And so this tells you that the measurements will give you a good estimate of what the charge is for time scale scaling as L divided by P. And so in particular, if you take L to infinity, you never actually collapse. And so this is true in this fuzzy phase where the charge fluctuations remain significant until this time scale here. That scales with L, whereas in the sharp phase, the claim is that this time scale will not. So at least intuitively, this kind of tells you what the time scale, what the fundamental time scale is in that fuzzy phase. And so that's something you can also check numerically. So this plot here is some estimation of like the number of trajectories for which charge is fully collapsed. And as a function of T over L, it's something that that scales pretty nicely. So you can try to go beyond this. And so that's something we did. And in the end, I think that's maybe the one of the most surprising things is that to a large extent, this transition you can understand using relatively standard tools. And so this is something that was really allowed by the statistical mechanics mapping I was telling you about. So that statistical mechanics model, you can sit down and think more about it. So it's effectively classical, and there's some, like I said, there's some quench disorder. And so you can deal with this disorder from using yet another replica trick. So since slightly circular, I said we had a replica trick and in the original model, and here I'm using yet another replica trick for the StatMec model. Just because many of us are more used to thinking in terms of Hamiltonian rather than transfer matrices, it's useful to think of a Hamiltonian version of this model. So you can map this transfer matrix or Markov operator if you want to some effective Hamiltonian. And the end result is as follows, and it's, I think, pretty simple and pretty intuitive. You end up with some effective Hamiltonian where you have spin 1/2 degrees of freedom on all sides. Now this is, you know, an effective Hamiltonian that describes the statistical mechanics model. A labels replicas. So without the measurements, your dynamics is given by an Heisenberg failed magnet. So why is that? Well, so this, you can convince yourself, describes the random walkers. And so in fact, there's a very well-known mapping between the symmetric exclusion process and this Heisenberg failed magnet. Intuitively, you can think that this has a gap with scaling with a dynamical exponent two. And you can think it just has magnon excitations that diffuse. And this is precisely describing this kind of diffusion process. Okay. And on top of it, you have the measurements. And what the measurements do is they couple the different replicas. Okay. And so anything that's symmetric between my different replicas is not touched by the measurements. And so this will play no role in the physics I want to tell you about. But the measurements will effectively couple those replicas. And once you have a Hamiltonian like this, you can actually now follow more standard tools of just many-body quantum physics. We don't have a non-equilibrium complicated problems anymore. We're actually interested in the low energy properties of this Hamiltonian, because now I'm in imaginary time, right? So we want the low energy physics of this Hamiltonian, and that we can do using relatively standard tools. We can do a spin wave expansion of this Hamiltonian. You end up having a bunch of modes. You write each spin in a path integral, coherent state path integral. You have some angles, theta and phi. And your effective Lagrangian ends up having two parts. It has a part which the bars mean average of a replica. So there's a first part which may or may not be obvious to you. It's just an Heisenberg failed magnet. Has dynamical exponent two, and it's not touched by the measurement. What this is describing is just diffusion. So I should say, even with the measurement, you still have diffusion in your system, right? So this is not touched, and this is what this part tells you about. But after some massaging and so on, you find that the measurements give you a bunch of other modes, which actually have dynamical exponent one, are relativistic, and end up being effectively Luttinger liquids, if you want, in 1 plus 1D, or like XY models. They end up being decoupled. And Q is my number of replicas. And so those XY models, they can have topological defects, because you can have vortices in this model, and they end up having a transition. And so that transition is that sharpening transition I'm telling you about. So the nice thing about this is that it gives us not only a kind of a physical picture of what this transition is, but it gives us some full analytic control, at least in that limit where we have this large D parameter on what that transition is. So we have a fancy name for that regime where you have, like, we call it charge fuzzy, but we also call it inter-replica superfluid. And it's based on the following picture, that you have this model where you have those charges then that are just doing their random walks. And now we have copied the system, we have different replicas. And if, without measurements, those different copies, they do not interact and they're completely independent from each other. So if you have, if your measurements are kind of weak or sparse enough, the fluctuations between the replicas are very strong. And that corresponds to a regime where you effectively have a superfluid, if you want, or you have like those XY model modes. But eventually, if you measure the system enough, you will basically lock some of your replicas together. And that gives you a transition. So this is like a superfluid to insulator transition, if you'd like, where the inter-replica modes will be strongly coupled. And that corresponds to some proliferation of a topological defect in that theory. And so based on all of this, we can also get the scaling of various critical functions. So at the end of the day, like the charge correlations, what's pretty amazing in the system is they end up looking like that of a Luttinger liquid. So in the Luttinger liquid, if you look at charge correlation functions, they decay as one of x squared. And here, this ends up being the same. But again, it's pretty crazy that we're getting Luttinger liquid type physics here. So as you say, so Luttinger liquid only have diagonal correlations here. There's no off diagonal things going on. But if you only look at those diagonal Z correlations, charge correlations, The only thing I have is unitary dynamics and some measurements. And I will get a critical like state, which is effectively almost like a Luttinger liquid, at least when P is relatively small. And if you have this sharpening transition where effectively those correlations will start decaying exponentially. So we understand many things. You can construct operators that have continuously evolving exponents. So you can construct some kind of dual vortex operators. And the charge variance here, naturally follows and is a log from this. And in fact, the slope of the log gives you, if you want the Luttinger parameter or the superfluid fraction of that state. Okay, so let me wrap up and take some questions. So I've, hopefully convinced you that there's some pretty interesting physics going on in those monitored quantum circuits, where you can have new classes of entanglement transitions or measurement induced phase transitions with minimal ingredients. So adding symmetries really enrich the picture. You could expect that this would be true. And there are many other works in recent years that have really realized many cool things that can happen with symmetries. With a conserved charge, we find that there's a completely new transition in the ability of measurements to kind of extract or reveal the charge of the states. And that occurs completely in the volume low states, which is maybe surprising. The other thing is that we have some pretty controlled theories for those transitions that occur in the volume low phase. So I didn't go into any type of technical detail for the statistical mapping. But I refer you to, I'm happy to answer questions if you're curious about this, but you can have a look at our papers. And the nice thing about the statistical mappings here is that they allow for, they give you some nice models that you can at least simulate numerically very efficiently. So it's not as hard as the original quantum problem, but it also allows you to have some effective field theory techniques, which also you could generalize to other symmetry groups or to higher dimension, for example. Okay. So I should say that the field theory approach I've briefly outlined, we really benchmarked against numerics and it seems to work very well. So there are many, many open questions and many future directions. You could think about generalizations to higher dimensions, to different symmetry groups. The more practical ways to think of it, this charge sharpening transitions going around this post-selection problem, relation to some decoding problems and so on. And so those are some of the things we're thinking about right now. And so with this, let me just thank you very much for your attention and maybe take questions.
Thanks, Roman. It was a great talk. Maybe I could just start with one question about if you only had the charged qubit without the large qubit attached, are there also two separate transitions in that case?
So it's a great question. So this is something we did, more precisely, so our collaborators, mostly at Rutgers, did. So they studied a model where you only have this qubit degree of freedom and you don't have this qubit. And here, really, the only thing you can do is ab initio numerics. I mean, you can write a stat mech model, but it's too complicated to do anything with. And so what they have evidence, from numerics that you still have two phase transitions. But it's a bit tricky because they end up being very close to each other. And so I forgot the exact numbers, but it's like you have an entanglement transition at a P equals 0.12, and you have this charge sharpening transition at P equals 0.9 or something. So they happen to be very close to each other. And you could think that maybe with the numerical precision and, you get different crossings and you get different exponents. And we have, I think, pretty decent evidence that they're actually quite separated. But this is finite size numerics on 20-ish qubits and talking about two transitions that are pretty close to each other. So what we think, we know for sure they are separated at infinite D. And I think it's pretty clear they remain separated with one of the D corrections. And so, the question is whether there's maybe like a finite D at which they just merge and this sharp transition goes away.
I see. Okay.
So yeah, to the best of what we can tell, they remain separated even when you have a single qubit.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, we have some time for other questions.
Hi, Roman. Yeah, nice to hear your talk. So I'm wondering if there's also considerations of non-abelian symmetries, like
Yeah, it's a great question. We are actually thinking about this right now. I think it's a natural, you know, and maybe it's a natural extension. But yeah, so we're thinking of circuits that have an SU2 symmetry now. So I think there are, again, several reasons to think that it could lead to something interesting. Again, one reason is, okay, we might as well just do all symmetry groups and try to see if we have different symmetry classes. But again, I think there's a deeper reason for thinking of non-abelian symmetries. So non-abelian symmetries are cases where, you know, your measurements will start also to compete with each other, which is something that you can also do with, say, Ising symmetries and so on. But here with SU2 symmetry, it's clear that, say, you can measure. So your measurements have to act on two spins, right? And you can, say, measure the fusion outcome being a triplet or a singlet or something like this, right? Mm-hmm. And it's clear that your different measurements will start to frustrate each other, if you want, right? And so that it will create entanglement. So we're still working on this, and I don't have a complete picture of what's going on. But we know, for example, even the measurement-only problem, where you only measure and there's no unitary dynamics, it has non-trivial entanglement, which appears to be logarithmic. So even only measuring basically doesn't give you an Ariello phase, right? And it's maybe kind of intuitive to imagine that the measurements will kind of like just entangle the system here, just because they act on different spins and they will, yeah, they'll lead to some entanglement. So yeah, we do expect that having non-abelian symmetries will even enrich things further. And there in that case as well, we can also work out a stat-mech model. We can also work out some field theory things. And so we're working on this pretty actively, yeah.
I see. So it looks like there are two parts of contribution to the entanglement. One is from this d-qubits, right, which is doesn't carry the charge. The other is the fusion tree itself also leads to entanglement.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, so in the model I told you about, it's also true that entanglement kind of decomposes onto two contributions. One comes from the qubits and one comes from that U1 degree of freedom. Of course, one should be a bit careful. Like all those things are kind of actual, they're talking to each other, right? But in the stat-mech model, you basically get two contributions. And I should say for the SU2 model, some things end up being nicer. So we can do some things even without having that qdit, right? So that qdit for us was purely because we needed it, right? Like, if we could do the model without the qdit, I would be happier, but we kind of need it for technical purposes. And for SU2, for some reason, some things become a bit easier and we can do some things analytically without the qubit. So we can think of entanglement a bit more directly.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Any other questions? So regarding the last point on this slide, I guess the hope is that somehow the decoding problem for observing the charge transition is simpler?
Yeah, well, I have some vague hope. At this point, it's completely half-baked, but this is just a general question about all those entanglement, all those measurement transitions of whether you can observe them, right? Or whether you can go around this post-selection problem or you can reformulate them as decoding problems and so on. But like here, you know, like it, I guess the basic intuition is that that transition, like that charge sharpening transition, looks a lot easier, at least intuitively. Like the only thing, you know, you gain information about the charge directly from the measurement outcomes. And we already know there are some things about the measurement outcomes that allow you to detect entanglement, all those measurement transitions, but usually they still have some exponential overhead. But we are hopeful or hoping at this point, I should say we don't have it at all, that for this charge sharpening transition, there may be some more direct protocol. So, you know, possibly related to this decoding procedure, but like more generally to just think of directly observing the transition in a way that wouldn't scale exponentially, at least, right? Directly from the measurement outcomes. And again, I don't have a lot to say except maybe the intuition that physically that transition looks simpler. It's really just a transition in that charge degree of freedom, and maybe it doesn't require, maybe it is less involved in some way than the original entanglement transition. But you know, it might be just as hard. We're still working on this, and of course, you know, but I think there's some reasonable hope to believe that maybe it is conceptually simpler.
Okay. Yeah, if there are no other questions, let's all thank Ramin for the very nice talk, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, very nice talk.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for the invite.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Ramin.
Yeah.
Very clear.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. See you soon.
Yeah. See you later.